Kwanzaa. Who's there? Hey, Michael, are you there?
Or is
yes, I am. Michelle, I had it right, Michelle. Michelle. So, we'll let the song play and then we'll come back. Well, there we go. We had to play that song because that's like a great song to open up with my next guest. And well, we're going to get right into it right now. My next guest is a former MUFON member from the Sudbury area who has had over 27 UFO sightings, including two caught on camera. He has appeared on several TV shows and radio interviews across Canada and different countries to research UFOs in Northern Ontario. I welcome Michel M. Deschamps. Is that how you say that? Deschamps?
That's how it is, exactly.
There
Deschamps.
We go.
Yeah.
We got something right tonight. So. Anyway, sir, thank you for coming on the show. And it's a little late, but you know what? This is the time of the hour and the night to do these kind of shows. And of course,
yeah.
We're here on Queen Street in Niagara. They got the street shut down and there's people all dressed up walking around outside here, and every once in a while you might hear a bang or two. Well, we've got aliens showing up at the front of our thing here, all dressed up, and it's quite the sight here today. So, so anyway, let's start off. Of course, again, I'll get a little bit. This is your second time on the show. We had you on a while back, but we didn't do too long of an interview. But we're back again, and we'll get into it a little deeper tonight. How's that sound?
Yeah, for sure.
Excellent. Now, you grew up, whereabouts did you grow up?
Well, I was born in Val-d'Or, Quebec in 1964, and then my dad, who was a miner, he moved us to Sudbury, of all places, in 1968, December 1968, actually. We missed, I keep joking about that, so we missed it by a year. And what I mean by that is 1967 was undergoing a worldwide flurry of UFO activity everywhere.
Oh, really?
1967, very famous year. But yeah, in 68, I was 4.5 years old. Then in 69, my mom, all this time I thought it was my dad who had placed me in front of the TV, but when the first man landed on the moon, it was my mom who placed me in front of the TV and made sure that I watched that. And from then on is where my interest in space came from.
Oh, really? Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Now, you know, growing up in that area, you were saying, you know, you just missed the flurry, but the way it sounds, what's been happening up in that area is it sort of continued. Now, did you have any early sightings like that sort of kicked this off?
I still don't know to this day if it was the sighting that kicked off my interest or if somehow I've been led down that path. I had a sighting when I was 9 years old, but it wasn't confirmed until many years later when I lived in Niagara Falls, as a matter of fact, for a couple of years, 1987-88. And I went down, I believe, on Queen Street to a little bookshop, a little secondhand bookshop, and I found a Canadian book entitled UFO Canada by Yerko Bunderchuck. And in that little book, that pocket book, there was a particular chapter that was entitled Sudbury and Eastern Townships. Those are in Quebec. Sudbury and Eastern Townships, July 12th to July 15th, 1974.
Oh, okay.
And my brother's birthday is July 13th. And back in that time, this being a summer, my mom had sent us to the end of the street where we used to have what we called it Teresa Park. But basically, there's a hockey rink, there's a baseball diamond. There used to be a two-story building where the teens would hold their dances up on the second floor. And on the main floor, the younger kids would do finger painting in the summer. And that's where my mom always shipped us out when it was really nice out. And that's where I happened to be when I had my first sighting. It was a daytime sighting of a metallic-looking sphere covering not much bigger than a meter in diameter, from based on my height at the age of nine, over the tree line in the distance, which were probably about maybe 500 to 600 yards away, and not tied down to anything at all. At that time, there used to be just a couple of parked U-Haul trailers and an aluminum shed and like a gravel parking lot, but now it's all built up with homes. The trees are still there, though, mind you, but that was my first sighting ever. But like I said, it wasn't confirmed until many years later when I bought that book in Niagara Falls. And then subsequent to that, when my friend Todd Frazier and I decided to do some FOIA, Freedom of Information Act requests, we actually bought the five, well, I don't know if it's all of them, but we bought five microfilm reels from the National Archives containing hundreds and hundreds of thousands of documents.
Oh, and you can actually access that?
Well, we used to be able to. Some people in across the country actually managed to get the redacted versions where people's witnesses and the witnesses' names are blacked out. Mine are not. Everything is there. Phone numbers, eyewitnesses, whatever. But unfortunately, I mean, as I tracked down some people, I found out that they had long passed, you know, after I've gotten my hands on the information.
Right.
And in those reels, I found two pages that actually dealt with the sightings that I had witnessed as a kid.
Oh, really? Wow. That's a great great connection there. And I think it's really cool, though, too, that the connection that the book that you got was found down here on Queen Street, probably not that far from the station we're talking on right now. So
exactly,
a few blocks down. So.
Yeah, because I worked at the Park Hotel in the Fallsway, and I lived on Second Avenue, and I used to walk down that way all the time to go to work.
That's really cool. Now, one of the things I wanted to talk about, and there again, we'll brush on it if you want to talk a little bit about it, because it was a part of your life. Is you actually got involved with MUFON for a little while, right?
In 1991, after I spoke to Stan Friedman, the late Stanton Friedman, nuclear physicist. He's the one, he was a chairperson for the MUFON. He didn't say, don't join just because of that, but he had give me this free book list, and from there I started purchasing certain things, and then materials and stuff, and then VHS tapes, and then I joined MUFON, and
just explain what MUFON stands. For those who don't know what MUFON is, I'm sure a lot of people do.
Well, MUFON is the Mutual UFO Network, and it basically... they cover 45 fields of sciences. A lot of people think that there's no science behind the study of UFOs, but we're talking like everybody from hypnotherapists to physical structural engineers, or anybody that would actually look at soil samples, do analyses of different evidentiary kind of things that would actually be found at landing sites. For instance, through MUFON, I met or spoke to most of the time. I never really went to the States, never had a passport, but I contacted Ted Phillips, who is as long as he's alive, he's the leading authority on all physical traces left behind by landed UFOs.
Oh, really?
And hopefully some people will pick up where he's left off once he passes on, because very few people are looking to the physical evidence. People have jumped the further ahead and not going back and staying behind to first prove the evidence that they've landed here.
Right.
And then you go on to the other stuff. The other stuff will fall in place like dominoes. No problem.
Yeah.
And that includes the interdimensional aspect of it, which a lot of people, too many people, are jumping on that, and it makes it less tangible for us to tackle the physical, because it's less tangible than the physical evidence.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? So it's systematic, and some people may not like that. They may jump in bounds and hops over some of the steps that you have to take, but I've taken an approach where I've set myself back, where I have old photos on my website, the photos that have been analyzed to death and are still unidentified to this day because they've had negatives that come with them. Digital photos I don't deal too much with because you know that they can be played with.
Oh, yeah. It's easy to alter them now, especially with the technology now. It's, you know.
Yeah. And then, but I had no idea that the website was got, well, I mean, I know I'm jumping ahead myself, speaking about jumping ahead. But,
yeah. Well, I was going to come to that next. Yeah. What we'll do is, so, like, you were with MUFON. For how long were you associated with them?
I was with them from 1991 to, I believe, 2010.
Okay.
And the reason why I left is because I felt that it's almost a crime against humanity, material-wise or information-wise, to not reveal. Like, for instance, they have, this is what I found out, they have 70,000 plus case files that I've never seen the light of day.
Oh, really?
Right. Other than being in their monthly journals or their symposium books, which would be published at the end of their symposia, at year's end. They usually have their symposium held on the approximate time where the Roswell crash occurred, early July 1947. So July 3rd to July 4th is usually when the MUFON has their symposiums. And, you know, there's fantastic cases that would show people that there's definitely something highly unusual and highly strange that actually has been taking place for a very long time. And for a short period of time, I don't know if you ever even looked at the TV show Hangar One. They only had 6 episodes that aired, and then the show gets canceled right away.
Right, I heard.
Now
of
they
it.
Should
yeah.
do, they should do like, they should take an example from you, and maybe have a YouTube channel where they can actually run through all those 70,000 plus case files.
Oh yeah,
and tell
yeah.
instead of just you know, I've never been into this for money. UFO research to me belongs to all of mankind. And it's the one question we've asked ourselves so many times: are we alone in the universe?
Yeah.
And the resounding answer is no, and never have been, never will be. But so MUFON to me was interesting at the beginning. I was appointed provincial section director for Sudbury, Ontario, although I had nobody working under me.
Right.
And then once I broke away from them, I realized that I accomplished a lot more on my own. I even investigated a landing site, a landing case at, on Manitoulin Island, which was totally surprised to me. And when you're actually on a location when you know something weird happened, you get the heebie-jeebies.
Well, you know, what we'll do is we'll come to that and maybe talk a little bit about that. So one of the things, you know, so you moved on from MUFON, and you started, well, you did, you were talking about your website. So you started this website called Northern Ontario UFO Research. Correct.
And study.
Now that, so did that was sort of like the next progress, right? After that.
Well, I met a young man who was a friend of mine who was a padre in the armed forces, and he actually owned the website before. But the thing is, it's like I think he only had 10 pages. If you scroll down, I mean, there wasn't a whole lot.
Right.
And when he moved from Sudbury to Ottawa, and finally started a family. He basically gave me the website and gave me the run of it. And so I expanded from that because I was friends and, my mentor, my best friend, whatever, Errol Bruce Knapp, who had for many years, at least 8 years, I think he had a show called Strange Days Indeed that came out of Toronto.
Okay, yeah.
Every Saturday night, it was like a 2-hour program on UFOs. Initially was 1 hour long. Well, anyways, he passed away about a couple of years ago. And he's the one who gave me all my programs to start my website. So I basically took what was the previous website, and I created a template using the programs that I got. And I expanded from that. And then I placed myself in the shoes of somebody who totally knows nothing about UFOs, but what kind of question would he bring about in terms of wanting to know what are UFOs and what does it all entail? And so I've created pages that I have never seen on any other website. For instance, like what are the 8 or 9 characteristics to look for in trying to distinguish a UFO, a real genuine UFO sighting, from a man-made object, let's say.
Right, right. I was actually going to ask you about the characteristics of a UFO. That's one of the questions I asked for
today. Oh, okay.
So the website, what actually is the website and what's it all about? What's on it? Like, if people go there, what are we expecting to... There again, I'm talking to people that don't know what it is. So.
Well, initially, like, I know it says each letter, newforce.com, and each letter, Newforce, stands for Northern Ontario UFO Research and Study, but it now contains a lot more than just that. I'm one of three or four people worldwide that actually have a good document archive.
Right.
John Greenwald of California being one, Grant Cameron of Manitoba being a second. And then you've got David Marler, who's down in Ohio, I think. And so there's four or five of us that actually have like documents, like tons of documents. And on my website, initially, the whole premise of the website was basically based on the news clippings I had found in the Sudbury Star.
Right.
And at Laurentian University, they have not only that paper on microfilm, but they also have the papers from Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, Timmins, Kirkland Lake, and North Bay, our NORAD base. You know? And so it took me 2.5 years to look thoroughly through the Sudbury Star archives, and I found over 350 clippings between 1914 and 1989. I'm realizing now that the search in the newspaper archive actually mirrored reality in life.
Oh, really?
Because as I got closer to December of 1989, or the late 80s and the early 90s, the UFO articles became very far in between. I was reading more newspapers than I was actually finding UFO clippings. While out and about in real life, the same thing. It seems the UFO sightings back then, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, you had close encounters where cars would stall. Close encounters with pilots. I mean, a lot of cases, but, you know, some including, involving certain, like, death of pilots that had to eject because their planes were no longer functioning.
Right.
But those cases there to be convincing enough for anybody to realize there's something going on are not taking place anymore. It's as if the aliens have gone on to do something else. Something has changed their agenda or the fact that their sightings were so prevalent. We're not talking about just nighttime sightings either. We're talking about flying saucer sightings in broad daylight, whether you were chasing a vehicle, pacing a vehicle, or being chased by a vehicle, whether it's a police car, which we have had cases of that. I've heard a case of like that in Whitby in the 1970s. So things have changed.
Yeah.
And so that's why it's become more of an archive. And it took two and a half years to look through that. And I haven't done the other papers yet. I'm waiting to either retire, go back to the university, get retrained on some of the newer machines they have there, and try to do as thorough of a job with the other four newspapers as I did the Sudbury Star. But since then, I've added the National Archives of Australia. I've got the 9 so far downloads of from the UK. I've got the New Zealand files. I've got FBI, DIA, CIA, NSA, Canadian documents, and service documents, which was a co-joint American-Canadian series of documents about, because we had to make sure that we coincided our militaries in order to detect what these unknown submarines were or unidentified aircraft would come into our airspace. And things like that.
Oh, wow. Now one of the things, you say, like with the website, does that, like you say, what I'm trying to say here is Northern Ontario. So what does that encompass? Or does your website encompass a lot more than Northern Ontario?
A lot more. Initially, it was, like I said, based on the Sudbury Star clippings, but then I said to myself, I said, you know what, you got to put find as much as you can on physical evidence trace cases.
Right.
Because once you can prove the physicality of these objects, that they've actually landed here, then the rest is peanuts. You know, in 23% of all landing cases, there's been the observation of small humanoids next to the landed craft.
Right.
That's from Ted Phillips' statistics on his own website. A lot of people don't know that. I had a late uncle who actually had an encounter up in northern Quebec in the middle of winter with two small beings, and their vehicle was a ball of light sitting on the snow, and yet never melted the snow, never found any footprints, And my uncle, when I looked at his eyes and he told me the story, his eyes were glazed. I know it's Christmas time, people are having a few beers, whatever.
Yeah.
But my grandmother was there, my son, my cousin Louis was there, and they witnessed the whole living room becoming red. They thought it was a neighbor backing out, but when they looked out the window, totally different story. And
It seems to run like, you know, you guys are having sightings in the family. One of the things I wanted to ask too is, so you alluded to this, what was the first sighting sort of recorded that you guys have recorded? I heard you say something 1914 or 1917?
Yeah, 1914. I was doing a search. The Sudbury Star actually was called the Sudbury Journal going back to the 1800s.
Right.
I couldn't find anything pertaining to the airship sightings of 1896, 1897. Now, we know now, us ufologists, that sightings date back to biblical times.
Right, right.
You know, and back in the days of the cowboys, like Cowboys and Aliens, the movie, is basically based, or the idea came from, actual stories of back in Western days where some cowboys may have seen some objects in the sky that they could not explain.
Yeah.
Now, the 1914, it was a pure accident. 1914 and 1916 were two articles that I found that I did not expect. And I thought, well, okay, somebody will come along and say, well, it's probably a flight because the Wright brothers' plane flew in 1905.
Right, right.
Well, I found a clipping. I didn't print it out, but I'm going to go back and find it because the first flight from anywhere to anywhere was from Toronto, and it took place in 1919.
Okay.
So yeah. What was flying around at night with a light on in 1914 or 1916?
Yeah. That's kind of mysterious.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
And the fact that they wrote it down too, right? So
yeah.
So recorded it. So
yeah.
Yeah. No. That's it. So that would be the first. Now, you know, let's come back to, we were alluding to some of the characteristics of a. So we can go through this sort of the anatomy of a. What characteristics of a UFO? What makes it a UFO? And the different. There's of course there's all different types, right? That get observed.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Well,
we'll go through a couple of those.
On my page, I have a page that's called How to Identify UFOs in 30 Minutes or Less.
Right.
But sometimes you actually have to observe the sighting. You're not just observing the sighting. You're also studying the behavior of the object. I study the behavior of every object that I've seen, whether it's a pinprick of light, but it's how it behaved that was weird. It may not be its appearance or how it moved, but certain things that it does. Now, the 8 criteria that I have is the shape, the colors, the sound or lack thereof, the size, the speed, the behavior, the level of high strangeness, and also the duration of the sighting.
Okay, yeah.
I also have a separate page for theories and false explanations for UFOs, and they had everything from eye problems in the 40s to a swarm of glow bugs. They had an array of explanations for back in the day for UFOs, making the witnesses feel like this tiny, you know, like really small.
Yeah.
The shapes I have, like images I took from different pages where they show all the different shapes of objects that actually have been seen in the past. Then you have one object that was actually filmed through old camcorders, the VHS camcorders.
Yep.
It would actually give what I call the Batman emblem. Well, that's an actual artifact of the camera because people zooming in on the light source, they want to see what's behind the light source. Well, when you're trying to zoom in or rack in with a camera of any kind on the light source at night, you're going to wind up with a Batman emblem, which is basically a circle with bites taken off at the top of the bottom. It's not
right,
the true
right.
shape of the object. It's because the light source, first of all, you're shooting at night, and you need a really damn good camera or infrared or night vision in order to make out the shape, if you even can. And so you're not going to get the true shape or the true structure behind the lights. You're just going to get some kind of artifact through your camera. And you get a similar artifact now with a cell phone where if you have the sun in plain sight when you're taking a photo, you'll see these little green orbs, sometimes with little white specks in it and sometimes not. Well, if you make measurements from left to right and up and down on that picture, wherever the sun is located in the photo, that little orb will be the exact same position but opposite.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, And I've disproved some pictures like that on the website, too, because people sometimes just jump to conclusions right away and they said, oh, I photographed a UFO and there's the sun in plain sight. Some of the other stuff, too, is the colors, like the array of colors or the color patterns on the objects. Of course, the light configuration is not going to be the same as a plane. Sometimes they try to mimic a plane, like they'll have a slow pulsating light on them. But usually you can tell right off the bat because an entire UFO will be all lit up. A plane is never completely lit up, the whole body, I mean.
Yeah.
It'd be like you'd have like a plane shape completely glowing white, then that'd be something really weird to see. But I filmed some planes coming in to land at Toronto Airport just as I was at the UFO conference a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
And you can make out where the light is at the front. You got the international beacon light on the underneath the belly. You've got the wingtip lights if you're even lucky to see those. Sometimes you see a plane further away dead on. The sound is 10 seconds behind it. So you'll see the plane before you actually make out the sound. So it may look like a cluster of lights. That's why I say you wait till the end of the sighting. So once the plane passes you, you'll hear the sound 10 seconds behind it, seems like, when you're looking up at the sky.
So okay, that makes sense.
It's all these indicators. Then I've had to go online and find a color palette because some of the colors reported on UFOs by people are very, very odd. We're talking like vivid lime greens, vivid purples, blues, pinks, reds, that you don't find on communication towers, you don't find on other aircraft. They're very particular, and the lights are self-contained. They don't cast any light in a lot of cases. Our lights, whether it's lampposts or some light in a room, it'll cast light everywhere. These things are like self-illuminating, and the light is totally different. It behaves different, looks different, and the colors are very vivid in some cases. Sound is another tip-off, but a lot of times, some of the older cases, there was either a beeping sound or a series of beeps, sometimes the sound of a diesel engine or a washing machine that's off balance.
Okay, yeah.
Oh, yeah, there's been all these weird sounds in the 40s, a whistling sound, whooshing sound, or a humming sound. But a lot of cases, if you had your back turned to your sighting, you'd completely miss it because there's no sound at all. And it's happened to me where I've seen the object, but no sound at all, and yet they're moving fast like jet speed at 500 feet off the ground. And I, one particular sighting I had was these two objects, the best way for me to sketch them, they look like sea urchins.
Because
the nucleus is very small, but the rays of light coming off of them were really long. And yet I had my camcorder, my VHS camcorder, trained on them. And because the light source was not intense enough or bright enough, my camcorder never picked up on them. But yet with the naked eye, I could see these two objects moving north. And I was looking at them from the side. They were moving from south to north, and I was looking west. And I thought they were first attached to the same structure, but the one to my right was actually speeding ahead of the other one, so obviously they were detached.
Yeah.
So two individual objects, but really weird. I mean, they're small. You know, now it's trying to decide like how small does a UFO have to be in order to have occupants inside? That's another story.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Because you know? Like we expect them all to be, you know, our size, but who says they can't be a foot tall, right? So
yeah, a foot tall would probably be the limit I would bring up to. I've had one person reported once to me or said that they saw like ping pong size ball objects, whatever, right. Orbs. I would have my doubts that something like 3 inches tall would be piloting those.
Yeah.
In science fiction films, yeah, no problem. But in real life, there's got to be a certain limit to the kind of intelligence that's manipulating these vehicles.
Yeah.
And anything smaller than something that would have occupants on board, I basically call them probes or monitors that record everything and report back to something else.
Like, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Now, I was going to say, with the UFOs, are there any physical traces that they actually leave here? So some of the physical, like, is there physical stuff they do leave?
Yeah, a lot of times there's effects on the environment, like dehydration of plants. Sometimes there's a residue that's left behind, like a particular case in the States for 1971 in Kansas, Delphos, Kansas, for instance. Whatever residue fell off the object, it went down 14 inches into the ground. And the woman, for instance, who actually was working in a nursing home, touched the actual substance, and her hands became numb and were numb for the longest time. She couldn't even take a pulse at work. couldn't, were totally useless because she had touched the residue. Other people get a scorching sensation, sunburn type effects if they're in close proximity to a landed UFO. The physical traces, well, there's not always radiation on site. A lot of people used to assume that they were. But there's not always like a trace of radiation. I finally got myself a Geiger counter recently. But the thing is, the likelihood of me encountering another landing site would be like astronomical, excuse the pun, because the landings don't seem to occur as often as much as they used to in the past. I mean, like I said, it seems that literally they've gone on to do something else.
Right, right.
So it's becoming more elusive now to try to get the real physical evidence. And I always get crap by people saying, how come you can't get a good photo of UFOs? Well, the photos that I have on the website, they're all like classic. You've got the Rex Heflin photo. You've got the McMinnville, Oregon photo. You've got some photos from Trinidad taken by a geological survey, a Saturn-shaped UFO. Famous case. And you know, those photos have been analyzed to death. And now the thing that makes me laugh is you've got people with new processing imagery technology that want to rerun the photos as if they themselves can find something, you know, a clincher in that photo to make it no longer valid. I said, you can run it to any kind of machine you want. It still is what it is. It's an unknown and always will be.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, that's right. Well, speaking of physical evidence, too, and I was curious about this. Has there ever been crop circles observed in, like, northern Ontario?
I've heard of a few cases. Northern Ontario, not so much. I don't know of any cases here, but I know in Hammersburg, which is just not far from Windsor, there was a pattern that appeared in 1994, July 12th, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
And in that particular one, the I don't know if it's the police, but somebody said, oh, some pranksters created that. But yeah, how come they found a squished rat in that particular pattern? One in Manitoba, they found a squished porcupine that was caught in the swirling process of the crop circle. So if it was ropes and boards, how do you convince a porcupine to stay there while you're going to walk on it?
That's
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because back in the day, it was Doug and Dave, the two British gents that were blamed, or they were taking credit for having, created the circles, and now we're finding there are way more complex mathematics involved. And how could something like that appear overnight? You know, a lot more people would be caught dead in the act. If it was done by people, or you'd need an entire army. Some patterns are so huge that they almost overtake like three or four pasture lands or whatever. Or maybe there should be one that shows up like that. So then you know there was no way in hell it would be somebody making it, because you'd have to finish over one night, go home during the day, and then go back the second night to finish the rest of the pattern.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. There's such a mystery to that. So of course, and there again, I'm sort of sticking with, we're going through different, like there again, physical stuff. And one of the things, and I think this is highlighted on your thing. And of course, everybody hears about animal mutilations. And there again, has there been evidence of that? And you know, we know in other places, but I'm sort of asking about the Northern Ontario area, too. Does that show up once in a while?
I haven't heard of any reports here. I thought maybe once, but we also had a zoo here before, and apparently a cougar had escaped and killed a cow.
Right.
But because there's telltale signs, you can tell the difference right away with mutilations. Even a pack of wolves won't even approach a mutilated animal. So some kind of aura of energy or whatever that emanates from the animal or the surrounding area.
Yeah.
And so there's very little maggot activity at some of these sites. I hear most cases were out west. It's funny because I did a volunteer program years ago called Katimavik, which was for the youth. And I was gone for 9 months. And one of my buddies is from Alberta. And when I visited him in 1992, I missed out on 12 mutilations just by 2 weeks. There was six cows that were mutilated south of Leduc, Alberta, and the other six were in western Drayton Valley, which is west of where my buddy lives, like only 30 miles from there. And I missed those by a couple of years when I visited there in 92. But I brought back the news clippings. They had kept the news clippings from the Edmonton Journal for me.
Okay. Yeah.
So, in Ontario, not a whole lot of things like that. We still occasionally we're getting sightings, but not like the caliber of what was taking place in the past. They even got rid of our old radar base. Well, they all went. They all got rid of the radar base installations when they went to satellites. And I have the only surviving piece of paper from the Falconbridge radar base because I snuck up there before when the base was still up, like the building. The building had been closed. The radar base part of the installation had been closed in 86, 87. But the PMQs, the private military quarters, are now low rental units. And I once went up to the building, and we got in there back then, before they had started locking it up against vandalism and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And I actually got the elevating device permit off the wall of the elevator.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And it's framed, and it says Department of National Defense, CFB Force, Canadian Forces Station, Falconbridge, Pineview, Ontario. And then, and it's pretty cool. It's the only surviving piece because in 2007, they flattened the buildings right down. And I plan to make a 3D model of that because not only was it made famous in 75 when there was a flyover of UFOs at four U.S. military installations, which were nuclear storage facilities, but Falconbridge was not. Now, recently, my friend Richard Dolan had mentioned that on one of his podcasts out of Rochester, and I corrected him on that when I met him and his wife Tracy in Toronto a couple of weeks ago, and I said Falconbridge never had nukes, but North Bay had nukes in the 50s or 60s, and nobody knew.
Oh yeah, I remember hearing something about that.
Yeah, they were Canadian manned, but American armed.
Yeah.
And then, because Diefenbaker had canceled the Avro Arrow by then, and had replaced them with missiles, the Bullmark missiles.
Yeah, the Bullmarks, yeah.
Yeah, and so North Bay has had its own flurry of activity, and I was surprised to even find as big a clippings in that paper, the North Bay Nugget, because I thought if it's a North Bay base, a North Bay, a military town, they're going to keep things quiet. But in the yard, in the newspaper, big banner headlines. They had UFO encounters in July of 52, no, April 52, actually, that preceded the big flyover of Washington, D.C. in two consecutive weekends in July of 52.
So what do you think that the reason why they were doing that, would it be like they're checking up on us? Is that why they're checking out these places?
With North Bay, I would think because there's a long association with UFOs and anything nuclear, anything related to nuclear. That's why we've had sightings. Like I even made my way not too long ago to Pickering Nuclear Power Plant because I wanted to see for myself an actual site where a UFO had hovered over reactor number 3 back in 1975.
Okay.
And there's also one on Bruce Peninsula. Here up north in Blind River, which is another good spot for Bigfoot, mind you. Incidentally, because my friend Joan Morningstar is actually featured on one of the episodes of Indians and Aliens. Her abduction story is featured on season 2, episode 13 or episode 5, I think.
Yeah.
And up there with her, I couldn't figure out at first why so many sightings in Blind River. Well, it turns out that, and they've even changed the name, there used to be an El Dorado nuclear refinery.
Okay.
But they've changed the name to Systems Management Facility. It's like really, really nonchalant name for something that produces radioactive pills or pellets for the Chalk River and Deep River plants on the way down to Ottawa from my place.
Oh, really?
Yeah, when I go down Highway 17 all the way down to Ottawa, you get the Chalk River, Deep River. They have a nuclear power plant there. Well, what used to be the El Dorado nuclear refinery up in Blind River, they produce radioactive pellets for them. Well, that's why UFOs are showing up in Blind River. Here in Sudbury, it's because we used to have, because we... that's what I can't stand about Canadians. We like to sell out, and we sold Inco to the Brazilians, which is now called Inco Vale.
Yeah.
It's a huge mining complex. It has a huge smelter, and we have the tallest chimney in the world, I think, even to this date. And then Falconbridge, which was the company my dad worked for. Falconbridge is now called Xstrata, and I don't know who owns them.
Yeah.
Well, the mine site's around here, because this is also the location where the astronauts for Apollo 14 and 15
came. Yeah, they trained there, yeah.
Yeah. But because back then it really looked like the surface of the moon, there was a lot of erosion, because back in the 1800s, when the city of Chicago burnt down, this is where they took all the trees
from.
Yeah,
they cut all the trees down.
Yeah.
And then what happens is you cut the trees down, and then the soil all blows away.
With the erosion and the water and the rain, yeah. Well, they've regrown everything, so it really looks nice, even in winter, summer, fall, whatever.
Oh, yeah.
But here, the mine sites is what attracts UFOs. I've had so many reports, or a few reports, of UFOs sitting in tailings ponds. And as the person who checks the lines, because the tailings pond is the rejects, is the leftover of the processing mechanism for separating metals from the rock.
Yeah.
And a couple of cases I've heard of people walking to check the tailings ponds and the lines through which the stuff flows out from, and here is a 50-foot craft lifting, leaving a perfect 50-foot depression in a tailings pond.
Yeah.
So I've heard this from Elliott Lake, which also has uranium. And I also heard that there's a military, not military, but American, it could be military too. There's still uranium being picked up out of there, but by Americans.
Yeah, that's right.
There's a lot of stuff going on, and I think the UFOs, if you tie it into the abduction phenomenon, which is another it's less productive in terms of physical evidence, but the abduction phenomena is definitely taking place. And my take on it is I feel that if one or two of the visiting races had anything to do with our development, creation, or tweaking, the abductions to me are a way by which they are keeping tabs on us to see what next stupid move we're going to make. Now, I'm hoping to believe, like some people believe, that if we get to the point where we're going to self-annihilate ourselves with all these nukes and things, that somehow one particular race or many are going to interfere and step in and say, whoa, enough. You kids have already found the matches back in 1945 when you let off the first bomb. The UFOs were already coming here back in biblical times, but they came in force, in mass, after the first atomic bomb was let go in 1945.
Yeah.
There were sightings everywhere during all our wars. There were sightings in Korea, sightings in Cambodia. There were sightings in Vietnam across the European theater as well in 1945 with the Foo Fighters, you know, accompanying and pacing the planes.
Right.
We were being observed constantly. And still are. And even to the moon and back, all those six times that we went. And why didn't we never go back? In some ways, in an unusual array of words, they basically said, NASA, or some people at NASA said that we were warned off the moon. There is something there. There's a structure or a complex on the other side, and I think they're basically using it as a duck blind.
Right.
They have underground and underwater bases here on planet Earth, but the moon being on the other side, and the way the moon is geo-locked into the Earth, you only see the same side all the time. It's a perfect duck blind for them to just keep tabs. They have something to do with non-interference, but then again, the people who are being abducted would counteract that by if not supposed to interfere, how come they're abducting us? Well, they're taking genetic samples, and one particular abductee had said they are trying to prolong their species by collecting genetic material from compatible bipeds. And sometimes if they're in dire straits, they may not have any choice, and so they go about doing it.
And this kind of leads into my next question, because we keep saying, you know, they, and we've talked about the actual UFOs, but there's different types of, you know, belief of different types of aliens. And I'd love to, the actual people that pilot these things, and I'd love to get a little bit about, you know, your thoughts and there's all kinds of witnesses and stuff of the different types. So maybe we could go through some of the ones, and some of them say some of them have good intentions and other ones may not.
Yeah, well, for instance, Clifford Stone, who's American and was in the military, said that he was told that the U.S. military's cataloged 52 species, something like that. Well, on my site, I have 85 species plus an 86th one, which is actually an actual photograph taken in 1973 by a police officer in Alabama.
Oh, really? And that's on, now, your, when on you your look, site?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
And some years ago, I used to do, there's a program called Fire Talk where you could actually talk to anybody in the world for free online. And I actually inadvertently received a photograph of actual negative strips by the actual person who investigated that case. So I have photos of that being, which looks like a firefighter dressed in a foil suit.
Okay.
Taking at 10 feet, 20 feet, 50 feet. And this is Greenhaw, or Greenshaw is the last name, the family name of this police officer, who not only photographed the being, but also chased it with a police car, and it outran the car.
Okay, wow.
Through a field. So I have 85 different species, and then I separated those. Those are just the close encounters of the third kind. This is the observation. There's six categories of close encounters.
Yeah.
The first one is the sighting of a UFO, close encounters of the first kind. Close encounters of the second kind is the physical trace cases found, like, you know, animal mutilations comes into that, crop circles. That's different because I initially thought they were UFO landing marks, like especially the plane circles, but then when it got real complex, I said, no, this is something else.
Yeah.
Some kind of communication or something. Close encounter of the third kind is only the observation of small occupants next to a landed ship. Close encounter of the fourth kind, that's the abductions.
Right, right.
Then you have two more, which I personally added, unless somebody else has added them. You've got close encounter of the fifth kind, which is the eyewitness initially makes contact by flashing the car headlights or flashing a flashlight at the object, and the object flashes back.
So they respond.
Yeah. And then close encounter of the sixth kind is when a contact results in death.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And they've had a few cases of that. That includes two cases I know of human mutilations.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. You don't hear about that.
Thank God they don't occur. You're talking about benevolence and malevolence.
Yeah.
I think it's sad to say, but I think humanity is more. I think we've done more to kill our own kind than anybody else has ever reported the aliens doing so.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes I think that maybe humanity has had its run, and to have this Earth be brought back to its pristineness, maybe it's time that we went extinct and let somebody else do a better job than what we did as caretakers of this planet.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Involved in ufology, I thought I was just getting into UFOs, period, pure and simple. Then I go to these conferences, I meet the former Minister of Defense, Paul Hellyer. He talks about the banking system and how it's all corrupted, and it all ties in. It ties into the secrecy. You got all the other, whatever they call the conspiracy theorists. Well, did you know that term came from the CIA?
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The CIA created conspiracy theorists, and basically labeling all of us as that when it's their creation. So when I see somebody calling me a conspiracy theorist, I tell them, thank you for doing the job of the CIA.
Yeah,
because we're not conspiracy theorists. We're ancient alien theorists. You know, I believe that UFOs have been coming here way before. I mean, I've got photographs. Somebody found photographs of footprints in which one of the footprints, a trilobite, is embedded, and a trilobite is a small crustacean that dates back to 65 million years ago. So who sat down, who actually stepped on this planet 65 million years ago, leaving footprints in which one of these trilobites is embedded in it? You know?
Yeah, yeah.
We have more questions than answers. And those people who say they have all the answers as to which species is piloting which ship, which planet they come from, and what they call themselves as a race, they're full of shit.
There you go. Well, that we can't put that any plainer than that, right?
Yeah. So, yeah.
So, no. And hey, that's all great answers. So, one of the things I wanted to ask you, so you see something. What's the best way to go about recording, cataloging, and reporting it? Is there like a protocol to follow?
Well, I would basically make sure that I have, some people who have vehicles will start carrying cameras after they've had their initial sighting, that is. I know we have these cell phones. We all have cell phones now. But they take the lousiest photos when it comes to nighttime pictures.
Yeah, they're not really set up for
nighttime. And the zooms for the daytime shots, you know, I'd be pressed to say, yeah, they're pretty good, but not really. I mean, nobody thinks of grabbing a camera when they want to go out for a walk with their dog and they see a UFO. But initially, I say, try to memorize the date, time, location, direction of movement, the way the object behaves. If it does anything like high strangeness, like let's say if it hovers and you see the small occupants hovering around the ship as if they're making repairs. Now, that's been witnessed a couple of times. Now, you know, there's such things as flying UFOnauts, UFOs that can go to 0 to 30,000 miles per hour in seconds. There's one like that that was recorded on film north of Manitoba. We have one case here of which I've made a model of the Inco complex of an incident that took place in 1968 where the object was tracked on radar, leaving the area, mind you, in the area itself over Inco, which is a no-fly zone. It's as restricted as any place else that's military or whatever. Inco is a no-fly zone. The object was probably moving between, well, the document says 40 to 50 miles an hour, maybe less than that. But when it left the area, it was tracked at 22,000 miles an hour.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And there's been some that have been recorded faster than that. So that's highly strange. That kind of thing, we don't even have that. The space shuttle, when it was filmed back in the day when it flew, when it was like 100 miles out, and you have that one theodolite camera that was trained on it, at that point, when you see, all you see is the rocket boosters of the space shuttle in the full image of that special camera, that shuttle is traveling at 14,000 miles an hour.
Holy jeez! Wow.
So we have vehicles that are fast. So that one thing I would note is the speed, the direction, the lack of sound. Its appearance, if you can sketch it. I've had many people sketch objects as much as they can. Not everybody's a good sketch artist. Call any of the you can find not just my site. I mean, I've got a good archive, and I'm pretty proud of my work, but I owe it all to Errol Bruce Knapp, you know, God rest his soul, because if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't have a website. And I've been written up in other people's books, too, without me knowing. I just bought a book called Triangular UFOs, An Estimate of the Situation by David Marler, and I'm mentioned in there. Then I helped to correct the spelling. They were translating a French book into English book called Illustrated Catalog of Physical Traces of Canada. All the physical trace cases in Canada, there's a book of that. So you need to be precise about what you're seeing, and even the colors, too. That's why I found this weird, unusual bright color palette, so that people can go and there's numbers and letters at the top or whatever, and numbers at the side, and wherever your numbers intersect, people will say, oh, that's the color that my UFO had, and it's very unusual yellow or very unusual purple pink, you know, because some of the colors that they display, not all the time, but they do display colors that you won't see anywhere else. And the only thing we have to contend with nowadays too is drones. Like personal drones, like the Phantom 3, the Phantom 4, whatever else they have.
Yeah.
The military drones, you don't see that unless it's a military theater. We have no reason for the military to even be here unless they're refueling at the Sudbury Airport. I mean, I haven't seen jets fly by, military jets, mind you. Although when I lived in Niagara Falls, the American jets from the Niagara Falls U.S. military base, they will fly over and do a big loop over the Niagara Falls.
Yeah, yeah,
you know.
Sure.
And you can tell them by the engine sound. Oh my God, you can't miss out.
No.
But these things are so quiet that if you had your back turned, you'd be missing the entire sighting. You know.
Yeah.
But that I would take any detailed notes as much as possible, and then you just punch up online like. Like I said, John Greenwald's got a great site in California. You got Grant Cameron in Canada, who's mostly dealing with what the presidents know, the politicians or presidents, and what they know and knew about UFOs. And then there's my site, which is free access. I don't charge anything. I'm barely making money selling the T-shirts that I have. I have mosaics of the news clippings I've collected from not only Sudbury, but Timmins, Kirkland, North Bay, and the Sioux, and I have yet to sell any of those because I haven't spoken out of town. The only out-of-town gig I did was through the Laurentian University when he used to teach this. Get this. A religious studies building, okay? Religious studies building would teach a course called Dimensions of the Paranormal.
Oh, really? Wow.
Because they wanted to know how much they would affect people's religious beliefs.
Right.
And I got asked to speak in that class a couple of times, and then I got paid to go and speak. The same teacher was then going to the Nipissing University and just outside of North Bay, which I'd never been to before, and he paid my way to get there and to do a presentation in front of a class of 25 students.
Jeez.
And the odd thing is, these students, being like in their early 20s, never asked a question once. This past March, I get asked to go to the local library to do a special presentation in front of kids. So I had to dummy myself down to eighth graders and, well, nine-year-olds and eight-year-olds. And they had the most fantastic questions. And the neat thing is, age nine is when I had my first sighting. And whether you talk about UFO investigators, Bigfoot investigators, ghost investigators, age nine seems to be a starting point for some reason.
Right,
for a lot
right.
of people.
And that started for you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? I think, you know, we're coming up to almost an hour. It's hard to believe, eh?
Yes. So it's not hard to believe for
and
me.
We could probably go for another hour. But what we're going to do is, because I still got a little bit of show left to do up, and then we got to get going. But
really?
I'd love to, we're going to have to do this again. Is there any, now if somebody, like, so give out your websites and stuff and where people can contact you. And I think, yeah, we'll do this again in another month and get, cause there's more questions I want to ask and
sure.
We, you know, we could do another hour again on all kinds of other things. So.
Sure. And I would ask anybody who's looking at the website, if they see dead links, just to let me know, because I'll fix them as fast as I can know about them, because
sure.
My website now has over 1,434 pages.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's a big,
yeah.
big site.
I mean, I've got people's biographies. I'm trying to save a lot of stuff from the internet because I noticed that pages have been disappearing and information
right.
has been disappearing. I even got myself in hot water with the Swedes not too long ago because I had some of their old Canadian publications that somehow they had monopoly over, and I couldn't
right.
figure out why, you know?
Yeah,
so,
yeah. We'll see
so,
that.
And then if things go down, if owners of websites go down, like my website, if I could pay 20 years in advance for the site to run after I'm dead, I'd be happy. But so far, where I'm with my domain, I can only prepay like for 10 years in advance.
Yeah, that's right.
So but anyway,
okay.
the website is
yeah,
Northern Ontario. So it's the first letter of the following words: Northern Ontario UFO Research and Study. So it's N as in Northern, O as in Ontario, UFO, of course, and then R as in Research and S as in Study. So
okay.
New Fork.
Okay.
I know
awesome.
It's pretty similar to New Fork, which is the National UFO Reporting Center in Seattle, Washington, which is another good site. Peter Davenport hosts that one. And the lucky bugger actually resides in an abandoned nuclear facility.
Oh, really?
Nuclear missile, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so perfect place to have a UFO UFO website and a UFO center, you know,
yeah,
reporting center.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. So yeah. that's one of the places to you know, follow you. And then, of course, you're on Facebook and Twitter and all that, right?
Yeah, and you're pretty lucky down in Niagara Falls. You have the Flying Saucer.
Yeah, that's right.
And up here we have the Spacecraft Brewery, which is not really looking like a spacecraft on the outside, but I intend to approach the owners. I mean, I'm decorating their walls with the news clippings that they want. But also to see if they want to have my full-size alien on loan for a while because it's in my storage room downstairs and it's not really seeing the light of day. And
right.
I also want to approach them about if they were to get the projector and a screen or pull-down screen, I could do my PowerPoint presentations there. It'd be a perfect venue.
Yeah, no, that would be pretty cool.
And another project real quick before you let me go.
Yeah, yeah.
I have a business partner who's a poor guy. Has suffered a stroke in January. He's undergoing dialysis, but he's been a road map maker for the last 30 years, and he's developing mystery road maps that will include maps for ghost people who want to do their own ghost tours.
Okay, yeah.
And he's developing maps for the Kingston area as well, because all down south, Burlington, Kingston, Cambridge, that's where originally he's from. He's developing maps for ghosts, for people to do their own ghost tours there. But he's also over here, not just ghosts, but also developing a UFO like a UFO map, mystery road map, location specific cases, so people can grab the map out of a gas station, because they'll all be sold at Tourism Canada locations and gas stations.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's working on that. So
excellent. So awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thanks a lot for coming on tonight. Like I say, we're going to do this again,
and thank you.
We're just up to right on to an hour. So
thank you for the opportunity, and
no problem. It was great to have you on tonight, and went perfect with our show tonight. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to play you out with a song. I had a band here in right in the studio. These guys are called Running From Daylight, and they do this song called Elvis Ain't Dead Yet. And I thought it'd be a perfect song to play. It's a little bit of fun, and we'll play that out for you tonight. Thanks a lot there, Michelle, and we'll do this again.
All right. Have a good night, Dave.
Awesome. Thank you.
And my regards to Victoria.
Yeah, I will. Okay. Bye.
Okay. Bye.